So we are picking up this morning at Nehemiah chapter 2, and particularly at verse 9, where we had left off last week. And as we begin, I want to share with you a couple of verses actually from another Old Testament book, the book of Proverbs. They're going to use similar wording, but on the surface, it looks like the wording in each passage is taking us in different directions, almost like these verses are saying opposite things. So the first of them is in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 9. A wonderful assurance of God's providence and leadership in our lives. It says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Keep that in mind and contrast it with this other one a few chapters later, Proverbs 20, verse 18. And it is encouraging human planning, particularly by getting the counsel of wise people who have some kind of experience and understanding in whatever field it is that you're working with. It says, plans are established by counsel, and so by wise guidance, you ought to be waging war. We understand that those verses are stating facts about life in God's world, and they're not hard to understand, but they do seem to be going in different directions. It's almost like the first one is saying no matter how much you plan, the human level, right, is going to be overcome by whatever is the will of God, and he's the one that's got to establish your steps. And yet the next verse says, actually, your plans may be established by collaborating with wise people and by getting their counsel. That's how plans come to be established. Which is it? Is it that the Lord establishes what happens, or is it that our plans establish are established by what we think and what we do? Well, actually, there's a sense, as often in the study of the Bible, that both are true. And both have to be embraced at one and the same time. God is sovereign, and only what he decides is going to succeed will ultimately succeed. But at the same time, we know that the Lord works through means. And one of those means is human planning as well as human effort. These are both true at one and the same time. In fact, here's another verse in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 3, that brings the two sides together in one statement when it says, "Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established." So make plans, make effort, do the best you can to foresee what's in front of you and to figure out the best path forward. But as far as how much of that is actually going to happen, well, there is where we particularly rest in the sovereignty of God, and we take all our plans and everything we desire to do of work for him or work for our family or work for God's church, whatever the case might be, we commit it to the Lord and trust that of all that we had in mind, the Lord is going to determine which of those things is actually going to be firm, is actually going to be what takes place in his will. We are going to see that combination of ideas again and again through the book of Nehemiah. There is a strong emphasis in this book on the providence of God directing the life and the circumstances of Nehemiah. And the providence of God is while doing just amazing things on behalf of Nehemiah and the people of God in this post-exilic period. But at the same time, and as a part of what God is doing, this book also has an emphasis on the wisdom of Nehemiah and his careful planning and his diligent work and the energy that was put out both by him and the people at large, their hard work to accomplish the purposes of God in their age. And that dynamic, those two sides together, is right in the theme statement for the book that I gave you last week. Maybe you remember this. That to capture the theological message of this book, we're looking at God's work of restoration, very similar to what he had done in Ezra, but a different feature of getting his people rebuilt after the exile. But the Lord is doing that particularly through the contribution of a man named Nehemiah and the leadership that he was exerting over the people of God. It is divine restoration, yes. It is ultimately God working, and it is ultimately the decisions of God that are being carried out. But how is it that God is working? In this book, he is chiefly working through the ministry of one individual who is rallying the people of God and leading them in those efforts, divine restoration through human leadership. Those twin ideas, though they might seem initially to be opposite, actually symphonize perfectly in the plan of God, and they go together inseparably. Think about the passage last week as all of this process started, and the title of the message was How God Begins to Do a Work. The main focus in that opening passage was on the divine side of the equation. How the Lord first worked in Nehemiah's heart, and how the Lord then worked in Nehemiah's circumstances to launch this work of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. Even there, Nehemiah was not passive. He was praying fervently. And when the right moment came, remember, he had to stick his neck out and speak on behalf of God's work to a pagan authority to seek from Artaxerxes the emperor the authorization and the support that he would need to get this all done. And yet, for the most part, the emphasis was on how God is overruling all these shaky circumstances and uncertain things at this time and moving things, launching him on that mission. As we come to the passage today, now is the time for Nehemiah to act. Really, all he had done before was talk, whether talk to God or talk to Artaxerxes. Now it's time for him to do something about it. It is time for him to act. Look with me at the last verse in the passage from last week. And at the very end of Nehemiah 2:8, it says that the king granted what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. What a great summary of the amazing things the Lord did to get all of this going. He was assured that God's good hand was upon him. God had done things no human being could accomplish on his own. And now is the time for this man to actually carry out the mission, to take the resources that were in his hands from God's good hand, and to make whatever sacrifice was necessary and to take whatever risk were involved in order to carry out his part in the plan of God. And here is what happens next. Look with me in chapter 2, verse 9. He says, Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with me officers of the army and horsemen. You see here some of how these Bible narrators are so selective in what they choose to tell us, because in that one statement, then I came to the governors, that one statement covers a long and tedious trip of 900 plus miles from Persia all the way over to Judah. And who knows what he faced along the way? He doesn't give us any information about that. The narrative is rushing us to Jerusalem for the next big thing. But he takes with him the resources and the protection that the Lord had provided through Artaxerxes, and he makes that lengthy trip. And when he gets there, he shows courage in that he approaches the local authorities and he presents to them the imperial permit that was putting him in a position of authority himself and giving him the permission to lead the people of God in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And so here's this man. He takes his first big step. Never done anything like this before. Far as we know, had never been to Jerusalem, grew up over there in Persia, in a totally different environment, really had never had this level of responsibility or work before him. All of these people that he was going to have to be responsible for. And what is the first thing that happens? Look at verse 10. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servants heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. What a welcoming committee. You ever have a burden to do something? Let's say it's something very clearly for the Lord, not some kind of selfish thing. And you share this burden that's on your heart and you're trying to get support. And it's like all of a sudden somebody throws cold water in your face. Maybe somebody that you would have expected would have supported you. Or maybe it's somebody ungodly like what we read about here. This is the first response that he gets. His leadership and his faith and his activity is immediately being tested as he has begun on his mission. It's interesting to compare verse 10 to verse 6. Back in verse 6 we read, "So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time." And that little phrase, "it pleased the king," is literally, it was good to the king. He found it to be something positive, something desirable, something beneficial. It was good to him. That was his response. And then about these men, it says in chapter 2, verse 10, "it displeased them greatly," which literally is, it was bad, a great bad. Intentional contrast here. And these weren't just anybody's in this region. These were men of considerable power. In fact, it may be that particularly with Sanballat, he had authority over a nearby province, but had begun to assume influence over Judah as well. And here comes this new guy shaking things up and challenging his control and the direction he was trying to take those people. And it was bad, a great bad to him. Now what's Nehemiah going to do? Well, we're going to find out in our text. And what we're going to see is that Nehemiah begins to exercise the God-called leadership that the Lord had put into his hand. He pushes back against that sort of challenge. And he does succeed in getting the rebuilding project going. And as we look at what we read in this narrative, the title of the message this morning is this, Anatomy of God-Honoring Leadership. Remember, the focus is now on the human side and the kind of leader that the Lord is prospering in, exactly what is going on in and through him, and how the Lord is being honored and his purposes are advancing through the leadership that this man exercised this week. That is the focus on the human side. And specifically, we're going to see four elements of spiritual leadership that Nehemiah displays as he carries out his work. These are all means that are tools in the hands of God. These are all instruments that the Lord employs as he carries out his redemptive purposes for his people. And I think we have every reason to believe that these things are here to instruct us as to some other ways, beyond what we saw last week, some other ways that the Lord advances his work in the world, and really whether we are leaders in a particular situation or whether we are more followers, there's going to be some instruction and some encouragement for us here. So, anatomy of God-honoring leadership. And the first thing that Nehemiah has to do is to get a clearer sense of the job that is in front of him. He had some general idea based upon the report that he had received back in Persia, but now it's time for him to look into it closely, to get a better concept of just how serious the problems were, what the challenges were that they were up against, how big or how extensive the need was. And that brings us to this first element of God-honoring leadership, and that is his wise investigation of what needed to be accomplished for the Lord in this particular setting. Investigation. Let's read verses 11 to 16. "So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, And I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall. And I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. I think it's instructive that Nehemiah did not say a whole lot at this point. He didn't call for a big meeting right away. He didn't jump into the task immediately because he didn't think he was fully prepared. And he was not aware of just exactly how to go about this. He needed time to do that. Those 3 days that verse 11 mentions probably were spent resting after the long trip, interviewing people, beginning to make plans. But whatever information Nehemiah gained during that time, he wanted firsthand knowledge of the problem himself. And so he goes on this secret reconnaissance tour one night. And notice that we find here that dynamic of the human and the divine. And he just kind of throws this in as he's talking about, I really got to get serious to figure out what is going on here. What in the world are we going to do about it? And he makes the comment, verse 12, lest we forget what's really going on. And I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. He doesn't want to leave the divine side behind. He wants to remind us that that is the prompting and the power and the energy. It is this divinely implanted desire on his heart. And as he witnesses the devastation of Jerusalem's walls and thinks about all the challenges that would face him and his people, he is driven along and he is buoyed up by a deep sense that God himself had called him to do something about that problem. And this is ultimately what keeps us energized when we face challenges in whatever ministry or work the Lord calls on us to do. And we're down here often scrambling around trying to figure this out and trying to get a clear sense of what to do and making plans and getting ready. It is the vision, it is the burden, it is the direction from God himself that propels us forward into this. And with that on his heart, this man examines what is the southwestern section of the city. You see there a big picture of the city of Jerusalem at this time. And if you can see the orange kind of oblong section there, not exactly an oval, it's twisted because you're on a mountain here. Those orange lines mark out basically where the walls would have been or should have been, the walls that were being rebuilt. And here at this point, Nehemiah is down on the southwest section, and he goes out where that begins at that particular gate, the valley gate. And he goes down to close to the southern tip where we would find what we would more normally know as the Pool of Siloam. And that's as far as he can get. The situation is so messed up. And there is so much rubble in the way that he cannot go any further. He can't even make a complete investigation of the whole thing enough to have a sense of what is going on here. And he turns back around and goes back the same way that he came, having examined that part of the city for himself. I'm sure that that was an overwhelming sight for him to see. I'm sure it was discouraging to look directly at the condition of these walls and these burned up gates. But he knew he had to have accurate knowledge in order to make adequate plans. want to share with you some other verses from Proverbs along those lines that I think we see illustrated here and that Nehemiah was living on the basis of. He says, if one gives an answer before he hears, it is his folly and shame, Proverbs 18:3. And also Proverbs 21, verse 5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. You can think about your own personal life or maybe ministries that you have attempted to carry out for the Lord, and they didn't go very far, or you experience some level of failure, and sometimes we can attribute it. We don't blame God. Sometimes we can attribute it. I just didn't really know what I was getting into. Now, there's a sense in which we never fully know. But there's also a problem that these passages are talking about, that we can engage in something, even a good thing, hastily, without proper investigation, without having some concrete idea of what the need is and how we're supposed to go about it, and just with that sense of divine compulsion, just impulsively jumping into something and getting in over our heads very quickly and making mistakes that maybe could have been avoided because of a lack of what this man is doing and showing here, and that is careful planning and investigation. And I like what J.I. Packer has to say about this in his helpful Bible study on Nehemiah. He says, faith and planning must go together. When zealous Christians with strong faith allow themselves to go goofy when it comes to orchestrating a cherished enterprise, failure regularly results. Not because God is not responsive to faith, but because it is not his way to applaud and bless goofiness. So anything we can legitimately do to understand a situation, to come up with a reasonable plan, to assess our resources, to strategize and be intentional as possible about the need we're trying to meet, this is a good thing. This is a common biblical element of the wise life, and particularly those who are in leadership. But it's one thing to have good information and do the best you can with planning. The reality is, you're just one person. Nehemiah was just one person. Typically, to get a job done, you need a lot of manpower. And how is this man going to recruit the many workers that he would need to carry out this job? And particularly given that work on the walls had been silent. It had been abandoned for about 13 years since the original decree of Artaxerxes. Remember, we talked about that last week? These people are distracted by other things. We probably could infer that they were apathetic or hopeless that anything could be better or different. He's dealing with basically a demoralized or discouraged people. And it's great that he has a plan, but somehow he has got to persuade them to get on board with him. Somehow they're going to have to buy into this if this work is going to be done. And this is where we come to the next element here of his leadership, not just investigation, but motivation. He exercises leadership in the next couple of verses by exhorting and challenging and trying to inspire these people to a greater vision of what they could do and the contributions they could make if they would engage in this job. Motivation, that's what he's doing here. Look at verse 17. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we're in. How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, "Let us rise up and build." So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Very positive, upbeat passage flowing from the motivational speech that he gave to them, if I could put it in those terms. So what is it that he says to motivate them? When we think of a motivational speech, we tend to have this very humanistic, just kind of prop you up with stimulating feelings or some kind of unrealistic vision or some kind of selfish motive or just a tear-jerking story about somebody else overcoming their problems and achieving greatness, right? That's a sort of motivational speech the world understands. But that is not at all the kind of motivation that this man is giving here. And let us consider the factors through which he motivates them. First of all, the very blunt fact of the destruction of those walls. He says in verse 17, "You see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned." Nehemiah doesn't try to gloss things over. He doesn't try to make it seem like this is a small job that could be done without a lot of exertion. He is very honest about the terrible physical condition of the city walls and its gates. And that realism, it could have been discouraging, but that really wasn't the flavor of what he was saying. It really was designed to draw out their hearts of love for the city and the condition in which it now stood. It's almost as though he's saying, "Look at the city you love. This is the city of God. This is the place he has blessed you with. Think about everything he brought you through and reestablished you in this special, this holy place. And yet look at it now, how devastated it is. Let's do something about it." That's the spirit behind the honesty. And with that, notice that as a leader, Nehemiah includes himself with the people. He doesn't say, "You see the trouble you are in, so go and you do something about it." He feels with them. He takes it upon himself. He says, "Look at the trouble we're in. Let us build and fix these walls." That's not the only motivation he gives them. There's also another point that could have been understood as totally negative, but that ultimately is a positive appeal, and I'm using the word disgrace to speak of it. He says, "Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision." Derision, what is that? That's a term that could also be translated reproach or disgrace. And it speaks about the reputational damage in the world and the emotional effect of that, where the world was thinking very small thoughts, very negative thoughts, even mocking thoughts about the condition of those walls. This is a disgrace in the sense that we are suffering the reproach of those around us who don't belong to the covenant community. The physical damage has led to that reputational damage. Now, you could understand that simply as an appeal to what we would call nationalism. We are the Jewish people. We have this great heritage. We have these great stories of golden age before. Look at where things stand now. Things could be a whole lot better. We could recover the pride of our nation among the nations of the world. This is not limited to what we would call national pride. And we won't take the time to run this down, but let me encourage you sometime to read, for example, the book of Ezekiel in chapter 20. And it gives you a fuller picture of what is meant by the derision in a passage like this. That Ezekiel 20 is going to give you a mini history of the people of Israel, particularly their apostasy. And what it's going to say time and again, that was the ultimate problem or the ultimate effect that came out of the sins of God's people is that God's name was profaned among the nations. And for them to suffer reproach is for their God to suffer reproach. It is for his reputation to be sullied and mocked in the world. The God who claimed to have been not just the God of Israel, but the creator of the whole world. And this is what his people looks like? And this is their condition after being overrun by two world empires? They can't even build walls around their city. What kind of a joke of a God is that? And that was owing to the apostasy of God's people, where he stepped in and out of punishment for their sins, he took them into that condition. Of course, the world didn't understand that. And they viewed it as though the Lord had failed, as though he was incapable of defending his people and providing for them. And Ezekiel chapter 20 goes on to say, when the Lord promises that he's going to turn all of that around in the future and restore them, he says, I'm going to do this not because you're great or because you deserve this. I'm going to do this for the sake of my name, which you have profaned, so that people will honor me as I deserve, so that the nations of the world, in their eyes, my credibility is reestablished. My glory is brought out before them to where they are forced by circumstances and what they see with their eyes to confess, you know, we were wrong. He really is a true God. We're the ones who are wasting our time worshiping other gods. This is the one true and living God. He says, I'm going to work on your behalf to restore the honor of my name. It is for the sake of my name that you have profaned. That is ultimately what is behind Nehemiah's motivation here. Don't just kind of feel bad about the fallen condition of these walls and your state and how unprotected and devastated you are. Consider how this is affecting the God that you worship and the God that you say you believe. He's working to motivate them with that vision of God. Number three, he says as well, and this is on to verse 18, I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good. And he is giving them some sense of the providence of God and how it had worked on his behalf to bring him there in the first place. Since this is about God's reputation, God was behind it, and God had already done remarkable things to bring Nehemiah to this point. His good hand had brought him all the way from Persia, and Nehemiah wants to spotlight the providence of God and encourage them that just as the Lord worked on his behalf, the Lord can work on their behalf as well. And within that providence, there's also the concrete provision that was made on the physical or the material level by the king, by Artaxerxes, the Persian emperor. He says, I shared with them what the king did for me, the words that the king had spoken to me, which were commitments to provide the building materials, to provide the military protection to get over there to Judah. And those words that came out of the king's mouth were a reversal of that same man's previous words when he, 13 years before, had shut down the building project. And now everything is turned around, and the king is going to fund this effort so that they could complete what had been left alone for all those years. And so whether they think about their own circumstances or the fame of God in the world or the providence of God and all that he had done, Nehemiah as a leader is saying to them, you have every reason to step forward in faith. And I want to encourage you that this is doable, that the Lord is behind us, and he will prosper us. This is his message to them. This is his appeal. And it is so encouraging that there is this immediate positive response to that motivation in verse 18. Through his motivating words, the Lord worked in the hearts of these people, and they immediately agreed to carry out the work. This is like what had happened generations earlier. If you remember the story from Ezra, the first half of that book, that they had started the temple, that they had gotten discouraged, and there was like 15 years where the temple went unfinished. And after that period, the Lord raises up Haggai and Zechariah and starts to preach to them that this can be done, and think about the glory of this temple and think about all that this represents for the Lord. And immediately they responded and got busy about the temple and finished it up in pretty short order. Now the same is happening with Nehemiah. They started a work, they got off project, and now years later the Lord sends somebody to stir them up again, and they respond. And likewise, you and I, in whatever circle of influence the Lord has given us, if we desire to have an influence for Christ, to carry out his work as we try to do it ourselves and also lead other people in that effort, there's a great deal to learn from as we consider Nehemiah's motivation of learning to inspire people, not just with the mundane and the immediately personal or some kind of a material goal only, but to inspire them with a God-centered vision of how whatever little thing they might be doing fits into the bigger plan of God for the world. And to show them that they really can make a contribution, that God is powerful to enable them to be successful at whatever it is he has called them to do. And so, motivation. Now, everything's been upbeat so far, but that doesn't mean that everybody responded enthusiastically. In fact, remember those initial voices of it was very bad to them. And now they're going to come back into the picture as we go on to verses 19 to 20. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build, but you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." What do we see there about this man's leadership as he responds to this first attack? He already knew it displeased them. Now they're actually standing up and verbally opposing him. What we see him demonstrate as a leader is a great deal of, again, God-centered determination. The attack, this first concrete attack, is in the way of mockery, and it is in the way of false accusation that somehow they were rebelling against the king when really they were carrying out the king's order. We're going to see these men and all kinds of enemies, the pressure of this mounting more and more the further we get into this book. And we're going to see that they're going to use other tactics to try to stop the rebuilding. And Nehemiah is unmoved. And he immediately and decidedly pushes back against the pressure. T.J. Betts has this to say as he considers what Nehemiah said here. There is such a thing as a holy stubbornness. It is a resolve to obey God and seek his glory regardless of the cost and regardless of the difficulties that may come. Now, normally we don't think of stubbornness as a good thing because it speaks of somebody unwilling to yield and insisting on their own way. And the key word here is that it is a holy stubbornness. It is a stubbornness because determination is a matter of the will. And Nehemiah demonstrates he is absolutely committed to carry out this work no matter what. And he actually has an answer even beyond their accusation when he says there's a practical fact. You are outsiders. You have no claim on this. You are not Jewish people. You're out of your lane to even be speaking into this. This is a Jewish matter. This is not your issue. And yet, for all of that demonstration of his will and determination, it is a holy stubbornness. And one of the reasons we know that is because he says in verse 20, the God of heaven will prosper us. He will make us prosper, and we will arise and build. And even when he's talking to his enemies, he wants to make clear, this is not just about my will and my great power and wisdom as a leader. This is because the God of heaven is involved in this project. It is ultimately for him, and it is ultimately by his enabling. A holy stubbornness, or you could say a God-centered and God-reliant determination. That is a manifestation of faith. Faith is passive in the sense that it is a resting in the promises of God. But when it comes to actually implementing the calling of God, faith is a very active thing. It is about pursuing and persevering. That is the kind of God-centered, God-reliant determination that you and I need to be cultivating as well. One option other than that would be to just give up, but maybe the even more serious problem would be that we would continue in our determination, but to do it in what the Bible calls the arm of the flesh, or to turn God's work in basically a means for proving ourselves and our goodness and our power. This is not just human ratcheting up of the will. This is a holy kind of determination. Now, that is his attitude, and that attitude is vital, and we're going to see it coming up in other passages, but he also has to figure out practically how he is going to make progress and actually get this very big job done. And that's where we come to what's laid out for us in chapter 3. And the word I would give you there is mobilization. So we have gone from investigation to motivation to determination and now mobilization. What we're looking at here in this pretty long chapter is one of those lists that I mentioned last week. It is a big, long list of the names of the people who were involved in the project. It doesn't tell us the end of the story or the completion of the project. It's here laying out at the beginning of that who it was that was working and what part they were each concentrating on. This has been illustrated in this way, that this would be kind of like when a sporting event starts. We got the Super Bowl coming up next week, I think. And at the beginning of that, there's all this hoopla as they're announcing the starting lineup, right? You know, number such and such. Here's his name. Everybody's cheering and excitedly looking forward. All they're doing is reading names and people running out to the field or to the court. That's the kind of spirit in the context here. In other words, yes, it is kind of mundane, and it's a little hard to slog through these names, and it might seem kind of boring, but you would not have found it boring if you had been there and you were participating and you really sensed the need for other helpers, and then somebody reads off your name in the list. This would have been actually a very gratifying, encouraging thing that the Lord valued you as an individual and the part that you played, even if it is a relatively small part of a much bigger project. And let me show you another map of the city and how this chapter unfolds. This is zooming in on the area where they would have been rebuilding the walls. And the list of names starts up at the north and goes counterclockwise all the way around the city, identifying specific sections of the walls, often marked by gates, and telling us this group worked here and the family of this man worked there, and we're going to move on to another section, and these people, this other group was entrusted with that part, and we just go all the way counterclockwise around the whole thing. Now, this morning, we're not going to read through all of that, but I do want to point out two highlights. And first, as we consider the way that this list is given, a reiteration of what I've been trying to emphasize all the way through the message. And that is that in this list of mobilized people, organized, divided up, it is a God-centered mobilization. We've seen this emphasis all the way through the passage, and now we see it even in a list, even in maybe an otherwise kind of boring list. And I'm talking particularly about how this all begins, the very first part of it in verse 1. It says, "Then Eliashib the high priest, he rose up with his brothers, the priest, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred, as far as the Tower of Hananel." Here is the highest religious leader, and he leads in the effort. He is the first one listed, and he begins at that north end. Why? Because that's where the temple was located. And it's called the Sheep Gate because that's where they took the sheep through in order to be slaughtered for the sacrifices at the temple. In other words, this was the sort of formal, worshipful entryway into the city of God, and it's associated with the place of sacrifice and the place of worship, and here the high priest is involved. And once he helps to rebuild that gate, what does he do? It says he consecrated it. He sanctified it, you could also say. It has to do with dedicating it or formally setting it apart as in a special way belonging to Yahweh. And that sets the tone really for the whole project, that this is all about the Lord. This is not just about protection. We want God to have a fitting place, a beautiful place, a protected place, a glorious place in which to dwell and to be worshipped. This is all for the Lord. And so for as much as you and I might be impressed by Nehemiah and his leadership, this is not ultimately about exalting him. From the outset, it's made clear this is about setting it aside for the Lord. It's about exalting God, and that must be our aim as well in whatever ministry endeavor we carry out. And then finally, another important feature of this mobilization is that it is all inclusive. This was a massive project. We might struggle with the images I've shown you to get a sense of what was involved here. But it's been estimated that that kind of loop around the city where those walls were going to be was about 2 miles in length. The walls would have been 3 to 4 feet thick, and they would have spanned 15 to 20 feet high. That's a lot of stone, partially to be cleared out and then to be reconstructed. You had to get that from somewhere and move it to that location. And it required a great deal of people. And the passage, its point is, look, everybody was involved. Everybody played their part. Well, with one exception. Look with me at verse 5. Where it's talking about a certain group of people, the Tekoites. And it says about them that their nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord. It capitalizes Lord there. That could be referring to God, or it could be referring to a human master like Nehemiah. But either way, we are told in this otherwise glowing list that there were a few people, particularly some noble people, who, for whatever reason, did not join the majority and participate. Maybe because they were noble, they thought they didn't need to be getting their hands dirty. Whatever the reason, the only negative thing in this whole chapter is that these guys did not participate. Of all the things to have memorialized about you in the Bible. And it is there to emphasize that the vast majority, almost everybody, was involved. Everybody playing a part. That was an exception. Everything else in this chapter is commendatory, as it is giving the sense of the broad base of participation among the people that Nehemiah recruited. And when you read the names and how they're categorized and described, there really is a rich variety of individuals that are given to us here. They are varied in their geographical origin. Not all of them are from Jerusalem. I mentioned the people from Tekoa. That was about 12 miles south of Jerusalem. There are some other people. Verse 13 mentions they're from a place called Zanoa, and that's about 13 miles southwest. So even though that wasn't necessarily their hometown, and who knows whether they would stay there permanently, they wanted to have a part because they viewed themselves as the people of God. There's a variety in gender. Verse 12 mentioned the daughters of Shalom participating. There's a variety in the social class, not just the common people, but people from the ruling class are mentioned, other than these nobles. Several times it talks about the rulers of this or that participating. And there are priests and there are Levites that are mentioned in the accounting as well. And there's a variety of people as far as their vocation is concerned. You read this list and it mentions goldsmiths that are involved in that, perfumers, and merchants. Isn't that interesting? These people were not all, probably not most of them, builders by trade. A perfumer. What in the world does he know about building? Probably as much as I do. But everybody, even if they didn't feel like, well, this isn't my spiritual gift, right? We believe in spiritual gifts. We understand that concept. But there are times when we step out of our comfort zone, and because a job has to be done for the Lord, we all participate and we learn whatever we need to learn to get that accomplished. A wonderful picture of everyone doing their part, a very broad-based community here. And I thought about this as Joseph was going through Hebrews chapter 11. And he was talking about Old Testament saints. They're not heroes in the sense that they're just like us, and it wasn't about them, it was about their faith and the great God that they were trusting in and serving. And so this chapter, if you remember Sunday school, would be like an Old Testament Hebrews 11. That out of their faith, these people did a specific job. Now, it's not maybe as dramatic as Abraham and Sarah and Enoch, and, you know, stopping the mouths of lions. By faith, they built a wall. Doesn't sound very glorious. It sounds pretty minor compared to some of those other people. And yet their names are included. And there's a whole chapter of the Bible that gives the list. And the Lord takes note of these people that were mobilized and that had a heart out of their faith to work. Now, I leave you with this other quote from Dr. Betts. He says, "Accomplishing God's work requires all of God's people to cooperatively and sacrificially give their time, abilities, resources, and best efforts to carry it out." And applying it to today, a church's greatness is not measured by its size. It is measured by the percentage of people taking responsibility for what Christ has called them to do in his service. Greatness in the kingdom is marked not by numbers or bigness, but by service. Not by the things that make the newspapers or the history books, but things, however small, that God values because they are part of his redemptive program. And if you think about these people, what goes down in divine history about them is that they build a wall. How much greater opportunity, privilege, responsibility we have living in the new covenant age with a fuller revelation of the purposes of God in Christ. How much grander vision do we have of the purposes of God living on this side of the cross? May the Lord motivate us to be mobilized and to be faithful to Him in our generation.